Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This evening, we want to continue our discussion of the improper methods of thinking, of dealing with ideas and philosophy. I want to conclude the tail end of rationalism, the substance of which we did last time, and then turn to its seeming opposite, namely empiricism. Let us just first give a quick synopsis of what we've said about rationalism to remind you of the high points. This is kind of a checklist of the central tenets making up the rationalist approach. Ideas above reality. A strong commitment to ideas, to abstractions, to concepts, but it's like the conceptual focus gone astray, severed from contact with reality. An emphasis on deduction and a scorn for observation and induction, and as a result, mathematics as the model of the perfect thought process. Emphasis on the self-evident, on axioms as one's starting point, but not axioms based on sensory perception. So-called conceptual self-evidences, which cannot be reduced to observation, which means, therefore, in actual practice, out of context, out of hierarchy, just whatever happens to strike the rationalist. And then, because he has a sense of insecurity about this, there is a drive to reduce these axioms to the fewest number possible, and that pushes him in the direction of monism, the ideal of ultimately explaining and proving everything by reference to one principle. The demand for certainty, but at the cost of having to be omniscient. And in those moments when the rationalist feels he has attained this, he repudiates the idea that knowledge has any context. He never says, on the basis of what I know so far, this is my viewpoint. He says, I know everything. Reality has given me the total message, and that is what we call not only absolutism, but dogmatic absolutism. That is, absolutes in the form of contextless revelations. And then in practice, when he tries to achieve this certainty, he finds that abstractions don't lead him to it, so he ends up being concrete-bound, militantly separating every concrete or every separate aspect from every other, trying to focus intently on it and excluding everything else from his focus, which makes him heavily compartmentalized. You still with me? This is all just review. A strong commitment to system, order, logic in his thinking, writing, presentation, and yet its system or order detached from reality. It's actually an arbitrary system or order. And yet at the same time, he feels it's an order necessitated by the structure of reality itself, and that there are no options of any kind in the thought process. No room for choice. Seems to me this is getting a little too loud. No room for choice. You simply expose yourself and adhere to the structure mandated by reality. And as a consequence, a general hostility to emotion in the realm of cognition or guidance, generally. Emotion is seen as a subjectivist element that does not bring you into contact with reality, and it's something that therefore should be suppressed or pushed away from any cognitive or intellectual process. That's the essence of the syndrome descriptively. And we were saying on the basis of it, when the rationalist comes to polemics, that is, the method of arguing with other people when he disagrees with them, there are two distinct points in his approach to polemics. One is he feels a very strong need to engage in polemics. He feels insecure. However many deductions he has gone through from however many allegedly infallible axioms, however much he claims to have modeled his argument on mathematics, in fact it's detached from reality, and some part of him senses this, and consequently he has a driving sense he has to convince these people who disagree, otherwise the truth of his own viewpoint is rendered insecure. And that takes us to the point where we left off last time, his characteristic method of polemics. What does he do to try to refute his opponents and bring them around to his side? In essence, he bases his entire argument on ferreting out internal inconsistencies in his opponents. He tries to trap his opponents in a contradiction. He tries to show them, look, you said A, and now two paragraphs or two pages or two volumes later, you're saying non-A, so you have to abandon your viewpoint. That's what's called internal inconsistency, showing the man that even accepting what he says, he is not following it out logically. In other words, to put it another way, the rationalist does not try to refute people by pointing out facts of reality that their arguments overlook. Why does not he use this method? Why doesn't he try to point to observational facts that the opponent overlooks? That's not his realm. Facts are not his domain, not sensory observational facts. His realm is always ideas detached from reality. And therefore, if he finds an idea that he wants to refute, he can't do that by matching the idea with reality, only by relating it to another idea. And in this case, he wants to show the guy, given this idea doesn't cohere with it. In other words, he accepts as a characteristic method of functioning, he accepts the basic premises of his opponent. He does that as a matter of course. He says, okay, I'll accept your premises, but even so, I'll show you that you can't get away with disagreeing with me because you're involved in a contradiction. This is, by the way, the method staunchly advocated by professional philosophers of all schools and the only method that they typically recognize in any form of argument. You cannot challenge anybody's foundation. You can simply show him that if then he's committed a contradiction. Now, what is wrong with this method? Let me state as we go on here. There's nothing wrong per se with pointing out to someone that he has committed a contradiction. After all, rationalism has no monopoly on being opposed to contradictions. So it's perfectly okay, per se, to tell a guy in passing, you know, you just contradicted yourself. You said A, and now you say non-A. But if that is your characteristic method of argument, it is very, very dangerous. Why? Because you are no longer looking at reality. You now have your eye exclusively on your opponent, on his ideas. Your whole focus is on how can I trap him while accepting his premises? Now, the first thing this does is it makes you lose all sense of what is even worth refuting. No matter how insane your opponent's claim, if you are a rationalist, nothing is that insane because there's no reality by reference to which to judge. So your first thought has to be, well, okay, if you say that, what about such and such? So the guy could come in, your opponent, and say reality is made of Campbell's soup. And it would not occur to you as a, you know, real rationalist to say, well, but look, there is no soup. That would be simply a vulgar irrelevancy. You would say, well, if it's a soup made by Campbell's, then Campbell's has to be the author of reality. But if Campbell, and then you deduce and you go into this whole thing, it's obviously insane. Now, this is not an exaggeration, unfortunately. The rationalist attitude is anything which is asserted, with which he disagrees, must be refuted because it's there. It's like, you know, you have to climb the mountain. Why? Because it's there. And you have to refute this because somebody said it. Now that, of course, is already very devastating on your mental processes. It means you lose all sense of what is worth investing mental effort in and what is ridiculous. You get completely detached from facts, knowledge, cognition, reality. Any idiot, if I can use a pejorative term, can come in and say anything, and that sets your mental agenda and gives you your mental assignment. Beyond this problem, it is a very impractical method. It does not work. Why? Because inherent in this method of polemics is you accept your opponent's basic premises. You accept his essential approach. And once you do that, in the long run, you are lost. The only way to argue with someone is to challenge him at the core, as we'll see when we get to the objectivist approach to polemics. But that is the exact opposite of the rationalist. He plunges in, he swallows the foundation in order to have something by reference to which to demonstrate a contradiction, and then, of course, he is at the mercy of the opponent. He never gets anywhere because he's given in on the foundation. A typical example is a rationalist atheist, many of them are atheists, arguing against a theist. And the theist comes in and says there's a God. Now the rationalist doesn't ask on what basis, what's your evidence, etc. Right away he wants to find a contradiction. That's the only thing he knows. So he'll say, for instance, the problem of evil. Well, if there's a God and he's all good, etc., how do you account for earthquakes and diseases and all the evil things that happen in life? Therefore, that's a contradiction. Now, this doesn't make any truly religious person bat an eye. This problem. They have dozens of answers to the problem of evil, and it comes down to, in effect, God's definition of good and evil is beyond our ability to grasp. But someday in the hereafter, we'll see that all the things we think are evil are really part of his plan. Now, what are you to say in answer to that? Can you say, well, this is invalid? No, if you accept the idea of God, you have to accept the idea of something that is beyond the power of the mind, and then you are completely lost. You're just tinkling on the surface with trivia you've already given up. So it's okay to show contradictions in your opponent, but it can always only be as a sideline. After you attack the essence by reference to reality, you can make him squirm by pointing out a few contradictions, but it has to be just the trimming on the cake. It cannot be a substance, and yet that's what it is for a rationalist. So, of course, since it doesn't work, but that's his only method, he does it more and more and more, so he becomes a maniacal polemicist. All right, and now the last point about rationalism that I want to make. What is the essential philosophic base of rationalism? Now, this is not a new description, but my analysis of what is the basic philosophy, the basic metaphysics and epistemology that rationalism rests on. In a single word, starting with an I, yes. Intrinsicism, correct. From many different points of view, rationalism rests on intrinsicism. To begin with, his whole idea of a realm of dissociated concepts that has no connection to sensory observation would only be possible on some kind of Platonic idea. That is, that there's a world of real universals out there, real Platonic forms or essences, whatever you call them, that they're out there intrinsically in reality, quite apart from our minds or concretes, and they act on us, and that's what yields the awareness of conceptual information. If concepts were nothing but our abstractions from sensory data, you could never possibly have the idea of a world of separate concepts. So the idea already of ideas above reality implies some kind of ideas intrinsic in reality that act on us. That's the root of why rationalism rests on Platonism, which is really the essence of intrinsicism. And you can see it in many other aspects. The rejection of any choice or option. The rejection of emotion in any aspect of cognition. The rejection of personal valuation as having any relevance. All of that is the idea. Our consciousness can contribute nothing to cognition. We have to be an empty mirror on which reality is to write. And that, of course, is the essence of the intrinsicist view. Something out there acts on us, we contribute nothing. Another instance of that is the rationalist rejection of context. The only way you could know dogmatic absolutes, in other words, without reference to context, would be absolutes which you learn without reference to human consciousness. In other words, because consciousness would not contribute to knowledge, knowledge would simply be reality out there acting on you and producing this conviction like a bolt from the blue. So the model of the rationalist, his ideal would be, expose yourself to reality, contribute nothing, not context, interest, purpose, values, method of organization, nothing. You just expose yourself and reality writes on you. And that is why I say all rationalists are intrinsicist, at least by implication. They may not know the issue, but they would certainly endorse it if they grasp it. Now, the reverse does not, by the way, necessarily hold true. You can be an intrinsicist without necessarily being a rationalist. For instance, an overtly religious type who is not interested in reasoning or in deduction, who is quite content to just have mystic revelations, would be an intrinsicist, but he would not be a rationalist. Rationalism is a specific consequence of intrinsicism. In effect, you take intrinsicism and then you add in a conscientious person who wants to be rational and logical, who wants to think step by step, who does not want mystic revelations, he will end up as a rationalist. So it's like the best an intrinsicist can end up. An intrinsicist with a commitment to reason ends up a rationalist. An intrinsicist without can end up a mystic. Now, looking ahead, you can certainly see that there are three basic metaphysics or epistemologies: intrinsicism, subjectivism, objectivism. And there will therefore be three models, and you can guess that the other two will be associated with the other two possibilities. That's what I want to say about rationalism. And now let's turn to empiricism. Now, empiricism, it can be a little briefer. In many cases, all we have to say is it's the opposite, it says X. The issue will already be clear. It's less common among objectivists. In my experience, it's more common within the objectivist world among non-professional intellectuals, non-graduate students, and, as I've said, with no pejorative inclinations, among women, although that's not an absolute. But it is by no means restricted to women. I'd like to point out, just to motivate you before we get into this, that there are certain areas in which men characteristically think in empiricist terms. There are many men that I know that are rationalist in one area of their life and empiricist in another. In other words, a split approach is certainly possible. It is not the case that if you're one of these in one area, you have to be that in every area. And I frequently found men in objectivism, for instance, who are highly rationalist in their approach to philosophy, abstractions, and theoretical ideas, but then when they think about, for instance, their personal life or their personal concerns or their emotional life, they are very empiricist. They're all the things that they dislike in women when those women think about ideas, but they are exactly that same way. So you can, if you are not an empiricist with regard to formal discussion of ideas, consider the possibility that it might be applicable to you in some other realm of your thinking. In any event, in a general way, empiricism is, or at least appears to be, the complete opposite of rationalism on every issue. The empiricist, like the rationalist, is also, if we give a generous interpretation, confronted by chaos, swamped, confused, swimming amidst a complexity of ideas and needs some method of dealing with it. Now, the rationalist in the face of this tries to seize on some overriding concept or principle that he can see clearly in the midst of it all and deduce everything from this. The empiricist also seizes on something that he can grasp in the midst of the chaos, but it is not an overriding concept or principle. The empiricist seizes on familiar concretes and often also on emotions. And that gives him a sense of a tighter reality and a dealable with world, a world that he recognizes, a world that he cares about. So as a general description, if you take the best version of empiricism, the person is committed to reality, to fact, to observation, to values, but at the expense of concepts. That's an overall description. Now let's use the same numbering and just go down the points, matching it to rationalism. There's going to be some overlap because those points were more suited to a discussion of rationalism than empiricism, but that doesn't have to bother us. It's all one phenomenon in reality. We're just breaking it up for note-taking. So point one, then, on empiricism. The emphasis on reality apart from abstractions or concepts. Reality above or against ideas. The empiricist might use ideas, but he always feels that ideas are suspect. They are somehow remote from facts. They are, quote, academic, sterile, theoretical, unreal. They are talk. They are somehow detached from reality. Now, often, of course, this attitude is generated by sheer reaction to rationalism. The rationalist looks like the champion of ideas. He puts this whole imposing castle of ideas in the air, the way Leibniz, for instance, that we saw last time. And the empiricist says, I can't stand it. Throw the whole thing out back to sensory observation. That's it. Perceptual concretes. Now, the extreme examples of this in the history of philosophy in the ancient world would be the Greek sophists, who simply denied abstractions outright. And in the modern world, David Hume, who denied everything, except the empirical datum of the moment that went by. Empiricists, of course, like empirical data, which means something you can point to, some perceptual concrete. How it's related to some other concrete they less care about, because that involves concepts and connection and abstraction. How to understand this concrete, that also is not their forte. But to point to some concrete and say, here now, brown, or whatever it happens to be, some of the more ambitious ones get to here now, tomato. That is, for them, intellectually satisfying, that's real, that's convincing, that's clear. Sometimes I say this is done out of helplessness because they simply do not know what to do with concretes, and when they get into concepts, they start to swim. Sometimes, however, it is very militant, and it is a principled method of functioning, a principle of being opposed to principles or opposed to concepts. Now, examples in real life will convey this better than simply a description, because few real life people walk around saying, here now, brown. So I want to give you some examples, particularly since empiricists like concretes. So let's have some concretes of empiricism. Now, these are militant empiricists that I've got as examples, discussing real-life issues. But you'll see, I hope you'll see the empiricism naked and unashamed in these quotes. This is from a conservative, an arch-conservative, I believe, employed by one of these right-wing foundations to advance capitalism. And this is from a paper written on how to prove that man has property rights, which he is in favor of. I'm going to quote you two paragraphs. Now, there's all kinds of things you could object to in this, but I'd like you to focus on this. See if you can see in what way this is an arch example of the point we're talking about. Quote, "A few defenders of property base their defense on the right to life." He's going to refute that now. "They point out that a person cannot eat without at least implicitly establishing property rights over the food he consumes. Similarly, a person would have trouble keeping warm without some property rights with respect to clothing and shelter." Here, that is, by the way, the argument that he's now going to end. Here is an argument that, as far as it goes, is compelling. But certainly a person can eat without the rights to sell, trade, mortgage, let, give away, or bequeath his food. In addition, this argument applies only to consumer goods. What about the main concern of socialists, the raw materials and capital goods which constitute the means of production? Why should anyone own them? Unquote. Therefore, you see, the idea is you can't base property rights on the right to life. Well, we're talking about the right to property. What does he construe the right to property as? He wants to defend the right to property on the basis of the right to life. That's the argument he's considering. What does he then immediately reduce the right to property to? Does he say the right to use and dispose of material wealth? Absolutely not. Because as soon as he said that, it would establish immediately from in the nature of life, since it requires material wealth, you have to have the right to create, use, dispose of it. What would he say if you said the right to use and dispose of material wealth as the right to property? His immediate, I see you're not too familiar with these types of people. His immediate reaction would be, that is so incredibly broad, the right to use material wealth. That is so vague. That is so incredibly generalized. The right to use material wealth would include the right to eat, the right to chew, the right to swallow, the right to regurgitate after you swallow. Then the right to clothing. How much clothing? The right to sweaters in winter, but not in summer. And what if you live on the island of Bali? You would have no right to sweater by the nature of the right to life. And the right to shelter, what kind of shelter? How many rooms do you need? Now this is what, and then of course after we got eating and shelter, there's the right to sell, the right to trade, mortgage, let, give away, bequeath. How much can he bequeath to who? How can you discuss the right to property in terms of one abstract formulation, you see? To him, the abstraction simply blurs the reality. So the first thing his mind has to do is say, property is too vague. Eating, I can understand. Even that, of course, he's very old-fashioned, and the moderns say that's ridiculous. You know, you have to break eating down into all its steps. Well, of course, once he breaks it down to eating, he's completely lost, because why then any amount of eating versus all the rest of the things? And if you said to him, well, how could you have the right to eat, the right, mind you, without the right to produce, which he says production goods is a separate question. How could you have the right to eat? Where is the food coming from? He doesn't ask that question because he's not concerned with where it's coming from. He's asking the question, do you have a right to it? That's the concrete he's focused on now. And that's a completely separate question from where does the food come from? That comes next week when he gets a subsidy from the foundation to discuss production. Now, this is, of course, completely hopeless. He could never establish any rights by this method. The only way you could establish the right to property, the right to eating, is by right, the right to man's need of material goods. And since man has to produce those goods by the use of material means of production, it has to be man's right to material wealth. You have to take it on that abstract level. Without that, you're completely lost. But this is, you see, a true empiricist. And it simply strikes him as it's just talk, it's just abstractions. What has it got to do with the real concrete that we see in reality? Nobody ever sees disposing of goods. All you see is writing a will or swallowing or whatever it happens to be. So we have to take each of those concrete. You get the idea of why this is. Now, this is what empiricism is like in practice. And this guy probably never studied empiricism, but from the way his mind works, this is what it means to prefer concretes to abstractions. Now, here's from another conservative. Conservatives are very, very empiricist today when they're not rationalists. This guy is defending William James, who was, of course, an arch-empiricist. Pragmatism is simply a modern form of empiricism. And he writes the following in a letter to some publication. William James understood that anyone can argue from, quote, principle, unquote. All it takes is a little well-chosen double talk. It is much harder to mask the actual consequences. See? The consequences of an action are concrete. Therefore, the way to judge an action is not by some abstract formulation, does it conform or not to this principle, but by looking at what happens when you do it. Then you actually see. You open your eyes and the concrete strike you. That is the pragmatist version of empiricism. It's simply concrete boundedness with insistence that the concretes that count are the consequences of an action. So it's just a modern form of empiricism. Now you see here the tremendous skepticism about concepts. All it takes is a little well-chosen double talk to argue from, quote, principle. Anybody can allegedly prove anything. He just has to rig his words around and come up with some deduction. You see, the way rationalists do. Therefore, it's completely to be dismissed any discussion of principle. And so he concludes, quote, I think a conservative just has to be pragmatic. That is, judge policies, people, and ideas by their consequences rather than by the pious principles they may claim. That's very, very typical. Now, how are you to judge the consequences? How are you to know what consequences mean what about what action? Remember we had this whole discussion about honesty some lectures back, whether the used car salesman that was dishonest, and someone suggested judging by the consequences, and we had a whole song and dance about why the only way to judge the consequences is by reference to principles which conceptualize the long-range effects and how that relates to your standard of value. So this viewpoint is the absolute reverse of the truth. It's only principles that enable us to gauge the consequences. But here, we're supposed to use concretes without reference to principle. Well, how are we to decide that? And it comes back to by feelings. That's all that an empiricist has. And this is why they characteristically blend sense perception and emotion as one phenomenon. Simply, whatever strikes them directly. They don't even make a distinction usually between emotion and perception because they have absolutely no means to go by anything except their feeling. And of course, pragmatism is an arch example of this. Now, does that help to give you a clearer idea of empiricism in practice? I'll give you one more. Now, this is also a militant empiricist, but he's on the left now, not on the right. So you see there's no monopoly of political position on this issue. Now this is a letter I'm quoting from, received by the intellectual activist in response to the ad that it took out You know about the Russian shooting down of the Korean jet, and the activist took, intellect activist took out an ad and denounced it, and explained in what way this is intrinsic in the whole Soviet approach and why we should boycott the Soviet. This is a letter from a professor. I'll tell you at the end of what. But he is a full professor at a very leading, not top, but very good university in this country. I'm going to quote certain excerpts. Because he argues very articulately and thoroughly empirically against, empiricistically, against the act. Now listen to this. I'm just quoting excerpts. You say that Soviet citizens, and then he quotes from the ad, may not get jobs or travel or read newspapers or rent apartments unless the government approves, unquote. Could you please be more specific? American citizens cannot travel beyond the country's borders without a passport, i.e. without government approval. In what respects is the Soviet system more restrictive? American citizens who hold government jobs cannot change jobs without government approval if their jobs require security clearances. And no one can be appointed to a government job, county, state, or federal government, without government approval. In what respects is the Soviet system more restrictive? American citizens cannot read newspapers that call for the violent overthrow of the American government by force, or newspapers that print names of CIA personnel, or newspapers that provide instructions for making nuclear bombs, etc. In what respects is the Soviet system more restrictive? You get that? In other words, for this individual, traveling, reading a newspaper, renting an apartment, getting a job is a floating abstraction. That is much too broad. Who can deal with such an immensity intellectually as getting a job? You can't compare two systems in terms of the principle that governs getting a job in one versus the other. You can only compare concretes. Now, you can point to a concrete in the United States where you need government approval and a concrete in Russia where you need government approval. So what's the difference? I mean, is it just a quantitative issue? How many jobs? What's the difference? It's still the same for every concrete in one. There's a concrete in the other, so that's it. And if you said to him, well, what's the use? Do you get that approach? Do you see why this is empiricism? You see that you couldn't argue with this guy. You absolutely couldn't argue. Because suppose you gave him 50 examples in Russia against only 3 in the United States. What would he say? What? That was under Stalin. You can't talk about the nature of the system and the principles, etc. You just collect concretes. Now, you think I'm exaggerating. I want to quote you one more brief passage from this letter. You say that Soviet officials, quote, exhibit the same savage behavior every day toward their own citizens, unquote, that they exhibited against the passengers of the doomed airliner. Can you cite examples of such behavior from yesterday, or the day before that, or on any of the previous 30 days to take a convenient period of time? Unquote. In other words, he can, you know, on the crow epistemology, you can hold concretes up to 30 days. And that's all he's got. So all the rest is recede into the past. So you can't make these incredible, he calls it dangerous hyperbole of this kind. You could just itemize concretes, you see. Now this is what you call an empiricist. Now, this gentleman teaches at the University of Minnesota. He is a full professor of philosophy, and his specialty is epistemology. Now, no one can top that, except only one thing. What he would say in answer to what I'm saying if he heard it. All right, now let's turn to point two. What is the primary cognitive process according to empiricism? Of course, to put it negatively first, it is certainly not deduction. They generally tend to dismiss deduction as empty, insignificant. They tell you your conclusion in deduction is already implied in your premise, which is really true. All the deduction does is apply to a new case, which you knew in principle all the time anyway. So they derogate deduction. They actually derogate it too much, but I wouldn't fight with them profoundly here, because I'm not a tremendous champion of deduction either, simply because I'm very strong on the opposite right now, to counteract the balance. But of course, deduction does have a place. Nevertheless, for the empiricist, the primary process is observation. Now, if they are an extreme empiricist, like David Hume was, they will reject induction as such. There is no such thing as generalization. That's it. It's simply too conceptual. But if empiricist is not that extreme, they can countenance induction. The rationalist doesn't like induction. He finds induction very unconvincing, very tenuous. He says induction only gives you probability at best. We don't want that. The empiricist comes in and says, what? Absolutely right. Well, he wouldn't say absolutely. He would say, you're right. Induction leads only to probability, only to the tentative. There is no absolutes and no certainty. He's content with induction so far as it's heavily based on concrete enumeration, on examples. He likes the narrow focus, the specifics. But the more general the induction, the more he is distrustful. His instinct is always, when he hears some generalization, to try to find some counterexample that will shoot it down. His sense of it is a generalization is an abstraction. An abstraction is dangerous. It's shaky. It's probably, you know, unreal, unjustified. Therefore, when he hears a generalization, his mind goes right away. Try and find some example that will shoot it down. Here you can see a difference between the rationalist and the empiricist. Both the rationalist and the empiricist sometimes experience the sense that there's a clash between theory and practice, or abstractions and concretes. Confronted with that feeling of a clash, the rationalist says, down with the concrete, it isn't real, and follow this concept. And the empiricist says, you see, I always told you that concepts were unreliable. Throw them out. We have to go by the concrete. As part of this same point, it's just a reformulation of it. Empiricists are very suspicious of principles. They do not like the idea of broad conceptualizations, insisting that the same consequences will accrue from the same course of behavior. For instance, this empiricist is just the type that if you showed him government controls would lead to disastrous consequences in regard to medicine, he would be all the more suspicious if you showed him that it also applies to the oil industry. He'd think, that's too easy. You're trying to rig things. You're trying to put it all under some one abstraction, and reality happens to be stubborn. That's what he likes to say. It's intractable. It doesn't fit your neat schemas, you see. So he is against integration on principle. Instead of trying to connect what he learns in one realm from another, he positively tries to disconnect it, because connections to him smacks of over-conceptualizing. And of course, if you're against concepts, you have to be against integration, because integration is what you do with concepts. So the empiricist is a compartmentalizer too, on principle. The narrower his focus, the more he shuts off everything else, the happier he is. As part of his hostility to integration, when he goes into philosophy, the empiricist hates philosophic systems. He hates the idea of system building. By system building, I mean the idea of integrating your views and philosophy so that it's all part of one total, proceeding from certain basic principles. Rationalists love that. They are the great system builders. Empiricists dislike systems. They like to think of each thing as a separate issue. To them, a system is the confession of weakness. So, for instance, in contrast to an objectivist, one of the things that an objectivist approach would like about, for instance, objectivism, would be precisely the tremendous systematization and integration. Sex is connected to metaphysics, and economics to politics, and education to aesthetics, etc. So it's all united. Now, of course, to an empiricist, this is not a virtue, but a scandal. This is a sign of weakness. And what is the word that he uses for any broad concept which attempt to integrate and clarify and unite diverse data? With an S. It's simplistic. Simplistic is the empiricist tag to derogate integration and conceptualization. So, for instance, an empiricist would carry this out, the real ones today would carry this out and say that my whole lecture today is a travesty. Because they'd say, you're trying to present empiricism as a systematic approach involving a definite view of A, B, C, D, E, and this is ridiculous. We don't have some principle governing our method of functioning. We do whatever seems appropriate in any given concrete situation. And therefore, empiricism ends up being completely self-destructing. It won't even stand for empiricism. You see, at the very end, it's like modern philosophy, which is completely empiricist and has self-destructed altogether. It won't connect anything to anything. And the result is they don't any longer know even what to talk about. That's the dead end, you see, of empiricism. In today's philosophy, of course, they also lovingly focus on concretes, but the concretes are words. That happens to be the big thing. Not concepts, but the words that people utter, and you have 75 descriptions of how they utter them and all the rest of it. Excruciatingly over-detailed. That's a mark of an empiricist. Does that mean that empiricists throw out abstractions altogether? Oh, no, certainly not. They have to talk. They think. They have theories. They don't just grunt and point. But what is the mark of their use of abstractions? Their abstractions are dissociated from observational reality, from concretes. In other words, they are floating. They are just like the rationalist abstractions. And they would have to be, because the empiricist says you can't connect concretes via abstraction. So when he uses abstractions, he feels perfectly happy to let them float, because they're not supposed to be connected to concretes. And you see, therefore, just as the rationalist, the champion of floating abstractions, ends up being concrete bound, the empiricist, the champion of being concrete bound, ends up with floating abstractions. And the philosophic rationalists are very, very open, empiricists are very open about this. If you look at David Hume, for instance, he said very clearly, there's two types of knowledge, two types of ideas. One was, I won't bother with his terminology, but he called them matters of fact and relations of ideas. And what it amounts to, one was the concrete bound form and one was the floating abstraction form. And they have nothing to do with each other. And that is a true empiricist, and that, of course, is one of the roots of what later became in philosophy the analytic synthetic dichotomy, which is the floating abstraction versus the concrete bound, you see. So it's just one expression in technical philosophy of this same whole approach. Now, we're still giving various aspects of the insistence on observation as against deduction or even induction. What would be the favorite subject of an empiricist, the way math is of a rationalist? Well, not just science. He would like usually specific science. He wants some science where there are no clear principles. See, so theoretical physics is already much too abstract usually for him. He wants some, quote, complex, dense, obscure, where there's masses of data, where nobody knows what they're doing, and no one can begin to accumulate it all, and you just pour yourself, you immerse yourself in it. For instance, sometimes they like history because they think there are no principles governing history. Or statistics. Or increasingly today, I notice they like psychology because they think psychology is all just studies, you know, of isolated trivia that have no connection to any other studies, and that to be a psychologist is just to memorize and amass these masses of data. And so that to them is the idea. Of course, they would hate the idea that there's a principle in psychology. From their emphasis on deduction, rationalists tended to be determinists. What do you think the empiricists tend to be on the question of determinism? They certainly are not determinists, typically. They don't say everything is inevitable. Their line is, who can understand anything? So they are tend to be what is called in philosophy indeterminists. Now, an indeterminist is not simply anybody who isn't a determinist. An indeterminist is, in effect, somebody who says anything is possible. There are no laws. There is no cause and effect. Who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? So you see, again, another false alternative on this issue. The rationalist says everything is inevitable. We can explain every drop of the universe by reference to certain principles. Nothing could be different. And the empiricist says that's ridiculous. This is a universe ruled by chance, chaos, who knows what's coming next, which is just what William James and the pragmatists said. And you see, all of this follows from a certain method of thought. The more you study these methods, the more you see that people like James and Dewey, how will I put it, are not as peculiar as they are when you first study them, because there's a very definite logic to all their central tenets. They cohere, it falls together from a certain epistemological approach. The problem is they don't tell you what that approach is, so it takes a long time to figure it out. But when you do, you can read philosophers with much greater understanding, I think. All right, we can rattle off now a lot of points about empiricism. Let's take one more before the break. What is their view of the proper starting points of knowledge? In other words, of axioms. What do they think, for instance, of the rationalist idea that there are self-evident conceptual truths which are the basis of all our knowledge? Absolutely out, anathema. Empiricist finds the whole concept of self-evident repugnant. He says all kinds of sins have been committed in the name of the self-evident. We have to get rid of it. There is no self-evident. Well, what does an empiricist think of definitions as your starting point? Only they're okay if you want to play around with floating abstractions. That's okay. But if you're talking about real cognition, absolutely not, he says, because definitions, according to him, are simply conceptual relationships. So they are therefore detached from reality. They're just social conventions. They're just linguistic. They're just people saying we're going to use these words instead of this word. So they're like linguistic abbreviations. And therefore, when he wants to think about something that he considers real, an empiricist has no particular interest in definitions. He might rattle off a few, but it's like a perfunctory social duty. Now, you see, a rationalist has a fervor for definitions, because he's going to hang everything on his definitions. So he will lovingly elaborate his definition once and for all. But empiricists, well, you don't like this, start with some other. What's the difference? Definitions aren't that important. Now, you see that rationalists and empiricists have the same basic view of definitions in terms of what they are, namely the relation of one concept to other concepts detached from reality. Only for that reason, an empiricist tends to derogate. Well, if his axioms are not definitions and not so-called self-evidences, what are the empiricist's characteristic axioms? Where does he start his thinking process? And the answer, in a word, is... what? He doesn't like axioms. He doesn't state axioms. No self-respecting empiricist starts off by saying, my foundation point is as follows. This is my beginning point. This is my axiom. He would say, that's fantastic. You just start with whatever you're interested in. There is no beginning. The pragmatists say we're enmeshed now in the total of human knowledge. Who can start as a baby and say, this is where I begin? You just start. You plunge in. There's no special reference for this idea, which is a so-called fundamental, as against this idea, which is a so-called derivative. Some pragmatists even say that's an elitist approach to knowledge. That's undemocratic. Why should some ideas be commanding and all-powerful, and others be just little corollaries way down the line? Now, we were saying when we discussed the rationalists that their insistence on axioms usually resolved itself into one axiom, so they became monists. What do you think an empiricist becomes? In other words, with regard to methods of explanation, methods of understanding, do you think he takes the view we have to have one base, one starting point? Absolutely not. Monism is to him anathema. What do you think his attitude is? The more the better. That's called pluralism. Pluralism. That is, the many as an end in itself. Because you see, pluralism is what you're left with if you have no conceptual framework. It's only concepts that can unify a complexity, that can take a whole multiplicity and make one principle out of it. If you don't have concepts, you like the multiple because it's multiple. Now, this is the type, for instance, that writes history books, textbooks. All textbook writers are empiricists, in my experience. There may be an exception to that. I can't prove it deductively, but I've never seen one that isn't written by an empiricist. And for instance, this is the method that usually puts off most decent people to history altogether. Because you come to the Civil War, and there'll be 5 causes of the Civil War, 12 causes of the Civil War. And you just have to memorize, well, the cost of grain, and so, and the northern industrialist attitude to this, and the abolitionist to this, and John Brown's body here, and this one there. And it's just a whole catalog, some fundamental, some derivative, some concrete, some abstractions. this person's theory, and there's no more expanding frontier, this theory, and you just memorize the 12 causes. Now that is a typical pluralist approach. If you want another example, the very last sequence of my book, where I quote this typical scholar on the cause of Nazism. And he says there have been, I don't know, 5 different theories of Nazism put forth. That it came from the politics of Weimar Germany, or that it came from the economics, or that it came from the German psychology, or that it came from whatever, socio-this, etc. And he says, I have no quarrel with these. We have to say there is no single line interpretation. It's a little of all these things and a dozen more too. Now you can read my analysis of that. That is a true empiricist there. And you see, that is in its own way much more hopeless to deal with than a rationalist, because a rationalist will say, the explanation, say, is capitalism. I mean, a bad rationalist who's a left-winger. He'll say the explanation of Nazism is capitalism. Well, you can argue with that. You can say, no, it wasn't capitalism. Germany was more anti-capitalist than any other country, etc., etc. It's possible to have a discussion. But the kind of guy who says, I don't care what your explanation is, one explanation is wrong, you can't deal with him. He's opposed to conceptualizing the phenomenon as such. And I've had much more hostility to my book on that ground than any other, that it is a monist interpretation, which, if you want to call it that, it is, because I say there's one explanation, philosophy. Now, in this regard, the rationalists are the theoreticians of the human race, and they are typically monists, even if their theories are detached. The empiricists are the eclectics. They don't come up with theories. Their idea of knowledge is to combine everybody else's theories, which they think is a big improvement. So they take 5 concretes and 12 rationalist theories and come up with 17 explanations. Now, this is advocated, for instance, in psychology today, which is a thoroughly empiricist domain. There were certain major theoreticians, whether you like them or not, in psychology. For instance, Watson with behaviorism, or Freud with psychoanalysis, and they put forward a definite monistic view, if you will, one theory, the nature of man. And however wrong those were, in my day, that's as bad as things were, but now, I mean my day when I used to be a student, now it's an intellectual feat to get a professor to reduce back to one of those. Because he will say, why do we have to choose between Freud and Watson and Skinner and 7 other types? It's a little of everything. Now that mentality you can't do anything with, and yet that is what they now regard as sophisticated. That's pluralism in psychology. In architecture, Ayn Rand satirized that in John Eric Snite in The Fountainhead, where he had all the different architects, and Rourke was modernistic. All right, let's take a break here, and then we'll continue after the break. All right, let us continue with empiricism, and I think from here we can run down fairly easily the other characteristics, and they will be pretty clear. Number 4, if you're following this numbering, would be the empiricist's attitude to certainty, which we've already actually covered. They reject the whole idea of certainty, of comprehensive answers, of definitive final answers. The empiricist approaches to stress how much is still unknown, all the limitations on our knowledge, the impossibility of saying this is the truth. In other words, there's a constant push in the direction of skepticism. Just as rationalism has a constant push in the direction of mysticism, empiricism pushes towards skepticism. Who can be sure of anything?
God.
The attitude to order or system. Now, what do you think is a typical empiricist attitude on that question? Yes. Right. It's against order or system as such, the exact opposite of the rationalist approach here. As he sees it, the choice is reality or system, structure, order in your thinking. And if you have that choice, of course, by his basic commitment, he wants to overthrow system, structure, order. Is essentially he's committed to an unstructured thinking process. There is little logical progression or development. He feels free to jump from anything to anything, very often by association. What is his view on the question of does man have choice or option? Yeah, everything is option. You can go anywhere you want, at any direction. So it's the same basic idea as rationalism, namely, thinking is a system detached from reality. Then one side says, do it, and the other side says, nonsense, overthrow it, let's not have this system. Or putting it in terms of another terminology, the rationalist says, we must follow logic, to hell with reality. And the empiricist says, we must follow reality, to hell with logic. Logic is just a game. It's just a way we put propositions together, but it has nothing to do. Real reality, he says, is not logical. It's, quote, dense, opaque, absurd, complex, irrational, non-rational, brute facts. Does this mean that empiricists shun logic? Not at all. Empiricists developed modern symbolic logic. For instance, Bertrand Russell was an empiricist, part of the time. But what is the thing that is the mark of the empiricist in regard to logic? Yeah. Well, in effect, you could call it that, polylogism, many logics, but that's a consequence. The essential attitude is, yes. Logic as a convention, logic as a game, logic as something other than a principle for grasping reality. And this is an expression of his view that concepts are floating. Therefore, logic is floating. And all the modern conventionalism in philosophy, that logic is just a matter of the way we use words, etc., is all empiricism. Now, you must understand that when we say empiricists are opposed to order and system, this does not mean that they cannot write a decent paragraph. Sometimes students misunderstand this point. An empiricist can write a book. Very often they're easier to follow than rationalists. They can write clearly, lucidly. There's a certain plan to their writing, often. In the case of Dewey, there is not. But in the case of many empiricists, you can read them very clearly. Their work is organized into chapters, etc., etc. So don't think that in some kind of superficial way that I am saying, whenever you see chaos in writing, that's empiricism or confusion. That could just be ineptness. It could be ignorance of how to write. It could be beginning in the field. It could be not organizing your thoughts on a particular subject. An empiricist can be a professional writer, lucid and clear. That does not change his opposition to order and system and logic in the sense we are talking about. The real thing that I mean when I say the opposition to order and system is the opposition to hierarchy in the presentation or acquisition of knowledge. The opposition to distinguishing fundamentals from derivatives. The opposition to the idea that there are certain points you must take and they lead to certain others. It's that he opposes. Principle of hierarchical structure of cognition. But within his non-hierarchical way, he may be very organized and clear. In fact, since he stays on the level of concretes, he's usually easier to follow than the rationalist who has these tremendous floating abstractions. Although not today, because he's discovered today, the empiricists have discovered symbols, so they don't like to just talk about concretes, they put it all in symbolic terminology now, so it's just a whole bunch of floating letters. Next, number six. The empiricist attitude toward emotion. Well, there again, the diametric opposite of the rationalist. We've already covered it. Pro-emotional. Freely feels and passes value judgment. He does this out of the essential nature of his approach. Because given that he just has all of these disconnected concretes, sense perceptions, how is he to know what to do with them? What conclusions to come to, what actions to take? Since he doesn't have conceptual guidance, what can he rely on ultimately? His feeling. Once you cut off the conceptual level, you have to rely on the automatic functions. And the automatic functions in this case are what you want, what you feel, what you fear, what you loathe, etc. Now the rationalist says, watch out for feeling. They will take over, you won't be in control. These alien thrusts will just come, they won't be part of your neat system. You'll lose control. What is the empiricist's answer? Who ever had control? Who wants control? We can't be in control. This idea of control is a myth, a rationalist myth, where we simply have to go according to the way the feelings strike us. So in the opposite to being, the rationalist, anti-emotional type is the fervent emotionalist type. We'll say more about this in a couple of evenings. He may not say it always in the form of go by feelings. He may make a big point of saying, I don't believe that. I say, for instance, go by what works. I think this is too loud because I'm getting an echo. Which is what the pragmatists say. Dewey has a long section insisting that he is not an emotionalist. You should go by what's practical. But of course, when you come down to how do you determine what's practical, it's by feeling. So it's the same thing one step removed. Number seven. The empiricist attitude to polemics. Now the empiricist characteristically also feels vulnerable in the face of disagreement. He feels uncertain, unsure. He says, in fact, that he's unsure. Nobody can be sure. What does he do if he tries to convince someone to the extent that he would? Well, sometimes he will give examples. Sometimes he'll point to concretes that he thinks supports his view. But of course, that is not too satisfactory because it's very hard to prove anything by examples, and somebody else can always find other examples. And usually he's arguing with the rationalist who dismisses examples anyway. So that doesn't work too well. Sometimes he clings to his feeling, because that to him is a source of security, and he says, I know that this is true, I feel it. But that's not very typical of him, because even stronger than his reliance on feeling is his idea, you can't really know. So typically, an empiricist confronted with someone who disagrees with him does not try to convince the other person, not after a certain preliminary, more or less feeble attempt. You can't, you see, convince on the concrete-bound level. So he doesn't try to coerce his opposition. His typical approach is to say, you disagree with me, you're no better than me anyway. We're all in the same boat. That's your opinion, this is my opinion. After all, it's a democracy. So, this doesn't mean, by the way, that he will not engage in theoretical argument with a negative motive or a polemical motive. In other words, he's happy to refute rationalist arguments. He loves to pick apart flaws and show that the conclusions doesn't follow. And every argument that he demolishes gives him the feeling another blow against the enemy. In this case, people who think that they can prove something by conceptual manipulation. Empiricism loves to tear down arguments. Sometimes it tears them down by trying to show what's wrong with them logically. More characteristically, he loves to find counterexamples, as I mentioned. He will hear this whole imposing argument and just zing in one concrete with feeling no need whatever to refute the argument. Now you can understand a person who would say, here's a concrete that refutes your argument. But you would think if he heard the argument, he would also feel the need to say, here's where your argument went wrong. An empiricist typically does not feel the need to address an argument as such. He brings in his concrete, and it just dismisses the argument. Anybody, you see, can argue anything. So what the hell, arguments are not even worth discussing, sometimes he feels. You see, the exact opposite of a rationalist, who finds this inconceivable, because a rationalist would say, concretes aren't worth discussing. Who knows what concretes are? Anybody can prove anything by concretes. But arguments, there you have to go, you see. So when a rationalist and an empiricist talk to each other, they have tremendous dissatisfaction. Each thinks the other comes from Mars. Each think that the thing that's convincing to him is unintelligible to the other, and is very unsettling to them. So to summarize empiricism, the valid elements are the desire to focus on reality, concern with concretes, with perceptual observation, with facts, and the recognition of some role of emotion, of choice, of options, but the fatal flaw is all of this is sundered from concepts, logic, structure. And now the last point, what is it, eight? The philosophy at the base of this approach is not intrinsicism, but subjectivism. You can't know anything. We have no means of grasping reality according to this view. All issues are decided by consciousness, ultimately, apart from reality. We go by our choices, which are not determined or based on reality, by our emotions, which determine our personal starting points, whatever interests us personally. We can never get out of our consciousness. You see, so it simply is the expression of the idea of subjectivism translated into a step-by-step methodology. Now here you see the paradox. The philosophy of empiricism, the motive, so it is proclaimed, is the focus on reality, not the floating world of rationalist concepts. But it ends with the idea of complete disregard of reality, an absolute entrapment in consciousness. And you see, that's what has to happen because of a wrong method. Since man can't know reality only on the concrete-bound level, when you try to restrict cognition to that, you drop out reality. And you end up trapped in your subjective consciousness. So each of these schools leads to the opposite of its intention. And here we have an alleged commitment to reality ending up as being based on an utter disregard of reality. Now that is the false dichotomy of rationalism versus empiricism. And if you go all the way back to lecture one, you can see in what way this is an illustration of the mind-body dichotomy, or as we put it in lecture one, the dichotomy between the inner and the outer. Standards without reality or reality without standards. Control by giving up the outside or the outside by giving up control. The rationalist wants control, standards, principles, reason. So it gives up facts, emotions, reality, and retreats into his inner world. The empiricist says you cannot give up reality. So he gives up control, principles, concepts, standards. To see these two arguing is a, as I've indicated, is a really horrendous thing, particularly if it's in the form of a man and a woman. who very often are in love with each other and find this particular thing simply indecipherable. Once the empiricist finds the rationalist irritating, exasperating, boring, otherworldly, full of hot air, and causing, what are they, or what is he talking about? I'm, for convenience, using the sexual stereotype. It is not always true. On the other side says, she is so disorganized, arbitrary, sloppy. What is she talking about? Now, here again, I want to remind you that you do not have to have one consistent psychoepistemology. You can be rationalist in one area and objectivist in another. You can be rationalist in one and empiricist in another. You can divide it up in many different ways. In my own case, just to mention a biographical case, I was very rationalist in writing, but not in teaching. I had a completely different attitude toward teaching than toward writing, for various reasons, which don't have to go into here. But rationalism very little tempted me in regard to teaching. And that is definitely possible if your psychology works a certain way. So if you're trying to apply these to yourself, don't assume that you're going to be the same thing in every area necessarily. Now, a few final concluding remarks about these two, just so we'll have a clear understanding of where they fit in the total framework of the human mind. Rationalism, empiricism, and objectivism, which we're getting to next time, but those three do not exhaust the mental life of mankind. Not everybody is a rationalist, an empiricist, an objectivist. There are several other significant categories. For one thing, you can be nothing. By that I mean you have no systematic method or approach, not in any field. You may be eclectic. You may have no definition to the proper method. You have no particular tendency to any method. Maybe you don't deal with ideas, or the person just simply accepts other people's views with no particular attempt to think them through by any means. Now, this sort of person, usually an unphilosophical person not interested in philosophy, will simply pick from various camps whatever happens to strike him. For instance, he can mouth an empiricist bromide, such as that's simplistic, one day, and the next day say God is the only explanation of everything, and have no sense whatever that this comes from two entirely opposed schools. Now, you've seen this phenomenon in ethics, in politics. It's not true that everybody in politics is capitalist or communist or anything. A tremendous number of people are nothing in particular. They just mix a whole bunch of different slogans in, and they have no even dominant tendency. Let me put it to you this way. Rationalism and empiricism are already an achievement of a certain kind. They are a certain definite methodology, albeit flawed. A definite way of dealing with ideas. And you have to reach a certain intellectual level to have that. Just as, for instance, in regard to ethics, to have a wrong view is already one step above simply an unreflective, unexamined hodgepodge of slogans where you couldn't say this person is an altruist or an egoist or a pragmatist or anything. He just is, you know, the pre-philosophy course type. All right, now that's one thing. So you shouldn't try to pigeonhole everybody by any means. Now then, there's another type of phenomenon that's very different from what we've been talking about. Both rationalism and empiricism take a valid element in human cognition and then distort it by separating it from the necessary other half. And that's what leads to all their confusions and chaos. But nevertheless, each does have, at least in its motivation, an element of validity. But that is to be contrasted with the position we can call outright irrationalism, IRR, which is, in other words, the open, deliberate rejection of reason and experience, of concepts and percepts. Now, for instance, the real medieval mystics, such as, you know, the church father Tertullian, he is not a rationalist, and he was not an empiricist. He said, it is certain because it is absurd, not because I see concretes which defend it, not because I see arguments which defend it. It's absurd. You can't defend it. Now, that's a different phenomenon again. Or take the modern nihilists, who delight in demolishing everything. Our senses are no good. Our mind is no good. Nothing exists. Nothing can be known. Nothing is of any value. That is a different phenomenon. In other words, not the implicit mysticism of rationalism or the implicit skepticism of empiricism, but the gleeful, joyous, ecstatic mystics and skeptics who love to obliterate everything. That is a different phenomenon. To take a simple example, Adolf Hitler is not a rationalist or an empiricist or an eclectic. That's a different phenomenon again. And there are still, I'm sure, many other possibilities. This is not offered as a map of the human potentiality. I'm sure that if we were to make a study of savages in the jungle, they're not rationalist, empiricist, objectivist. They're not eclectic mixtures of these. They're not irrationalist in the sense of nihilists out to destroy. There's something different again. They're completely undeveloped. They have no method and no discovery of any control over their minds yet. So they're imagistic, preconceptual, which is not the same thing as being anti-conceptual, tremendously fear-ridden, emotion-ridden, but that's not the same thing as what we're talking about. That's a primitive type of mind. They haven't yet discovered reason or experience as definite items of method. A baby would be like that for a while, for instance, or an animal. Or you could take psychotics. And there again, depending upon the type of psychosis, you have a completely different type of mind, at least quasi-psychotic, which is in part like savages, has some elements of being concrete about it, has some elements of floating abstractions, you know, certain schizophrenics will build castles in the air, etc., but still, they are crazy, and Leibniz wasn't. So, that's a whole field that I do not presume to know or to be commenting on. In other words, this is not offered as an exhaustive survey of the possibilities of the human mind, but simply as the dominant mistaken methodologies characterizing Western civilization at this time as a result of the history of philosophy being what it has been. And that means that it's very, very widespread, but it is not a universal necessarily in every culture and period. Now, I just want to caution you to think twice before you immediately see rationalism and empiricism everywhere. They are everywhere, but not everywhere, not in the exact way you would necessarily think. For instance, you cannot say, in so blithe a way as this, all religionists are rationalists. Religion is a rationalist phenomenon. You cannot say that. Religion is such a broad category. It includes so many types today. Some religionists are open irrationalists, like Tertullian that I cited, the real medieval type, which still exists today. A lot of religious people are simply eclectics. They accept some religious elements and some others, and there's no systematic viewpoint. There are definite rationalist elements in most religions of the West. To name, for instance, one, if you're a theologian, you are a rationalist. A theologian is typically a guy who tries to systematize the dogmas and deduce them from certain starting points, and that makes him rationalist. Or you could say the essence of Western religion is to explain this world in terms borrowed from Plato, because Christianity is really that too, the deduction from God. And that Platonist element in Western religion is certainly a rationalist element. So when you get to the more philosophically religious men, that's definitely rationalistic. But the way it stands in a particular man on the street, it all depends. One last clarification in application. Can you say all politicians are empiricists? No, just for, in the same way that you can't say it about all religious people are rationalists. It's too broad a category. It's even possible to have a good politician theoretically. But even taking them as they are now, there are usually today some clearly empiricist elements. For instance, most politicians are pragmatic. They're against principles. They're anti-ideological. And therefore, by implication, they're distrustful of abstractions. They tend to be skeptics and say there are no definite answers. They definitely tend to be pluralists and say there's no one thing. There's 75 laws we have to pass to ameliorate a given situation. But not even all of these tendencies don't really make them empiricists, because most politicians have not risen to that stage. They do not have a definite methodology. They're really mouthing a few empiricist slogans, more or less, by sheer dint of their college education. They've in effect been burned by ideas in the past, so now they're chary of them. They've given up ideals. But true empiricism is a philosophic methodology. It comes from a definite, even if implicit, view of what is required to understand something, to make it clear, to make sense of it, to make it graspable. Politicians today typically pick up some consequences of empiricism because it's so dominant in the colleges, but typically politicians are eclectic and non-intellectual, which is not the same thing. Now, that gives us a survey of rationalism and empiricism, and that leaves us for next time the last possibility, and you see a clearer idea of why the philosophy of Ayn Rand was given the name it was given, the perfect name for a philosophy whose whole approach is based on the objective as against the intrinsic and the subjective, is objectivism. And that, on all the points that we've covered the last 2 weeks, I'll go over them in order again, this time from the point of view of the objectivist view on these questions rather than rationalism and empiricism. And when we do that, we will then be able to turn to one of the arguments that we studied opening night, or that we raised opening night, namely, what is the use of philosophy in daily life, which we will finally be prepared to answer, having finally then next week grasped what is it to hold abstract ideas in a form which is not floating. So that's our agenda for next time. Thank you. There is a question that's asked tonight that irresistibly leads to the homework that was assigned in lecture 2 or 3, which I want to look at briefly, but first the question. When I come across an abstraction that seems unclear, I try right away to think of an appropriate example in reality. Is this approach empiricist? Well, in one word, this is very important to know the right answer to. In one word, no. Absolutely not. If you are confused about an abstraction, it is vital to be able to give an example We've been talking about the importance of concretizing abstractions from the word go in this course, tying them to concretes. The whole thing about empiricism is that it detaches concretes from abstractions. It focuses on concretes and says to hell with abstractions, but the alternative is not shun concretes. If that's your view, you're fallen into the very trap of rationalism versus empiricism. Do not absorb from the lecture the message of being skeptical of concretes. That would be fantastic. The point is the union of concretes and abstraction, the connection, but not the contempt with concretes, even detailed concretes. For instance, at some point, take that example we started the lecture with. At some point, if you're studying a right to property, and you define it as the right to the use and disposal of property, you have to, in your own mind, say, well, what would this consist of? What does use and disposal consist of? And if you can't do anything with that definition except say, well, employ and make use of or give some synonym, and you're completely trapped, you don't know it. You have to be able to say, well, use and dispose means create and produce and eat and swallow and sell and trade. You have to list all those concretes in your own mind. But the point is that is chewing to make sure your abstraction is connected to reality, not the way this empiricist guy does, thinking you could take each of those by itself and make a philosophic argument on it. But that doesn't mean you're therefore scornful of concretizing. I mean, it is really urgent that you grasp this point, otherwise you'll just fall from one alternative to the other forever. Now the questioner goes on, can you suggest the best steps to follow in concretizing? Well, yes, I did, but I think we better take an example. And therefore, let us take the one that was assigned. Now, this was a small, inadequate, humble exercise in which I don't want to put too much. It was simply to show you, when you have some concept, that you should always keep in mind, and if not, if you don't know, figure out, three different elements. One is its definition. Another is a range of concretes that come under it, a broad range, so you get an idea what this concept subsumes. And another is a series of non-defining characteristics. Why is it important to list all of these? Why do you need to know a definition? Anybody? Yeah.
Concrete, you want to bound it from inside and
from outside. Why do you want to bound it? Correct. You want to distinguish it from other concepts. Why? Because if you don't do that, you have no means of tying it to reality. You don't know what it stands for. So you have to give a definition. But a definition is just other concepts related to this concept. It still leaves open the possibility of floating abstraction. So what do you have to do to cover that? Point to concretes. Concretize. Give a range of examples. And why should you, if you have any doubt, throw in a series of non-defining attributes, which would be stated abstractly? Why should you put that in? What does that contribute? Yes.
So that you don't have the definition.
So you don't have a temptation to equate the concept with its definition. So you don't have a temptation of thinking the way to acquire knowledge is just deduce everything from this one attribute so that it's real to you. This concept names a whole bunch of different things. And if I want to come to conclusions about this, I have to look at all the actual attributes of these concretes, not simply the one that is my beacon in keeping it tied to reality. You see what I mean? So there are those three things. And where I think emotion comes in is in making the concretes relatively automatic. If you have your emotions opened, then as you utter the word, when you focus on it, right away you'll think of the things you love and the things you hate. And the concrete examples. Now, for instance, even with tremendously abstract concepts, just to illustrate this point for a moment, logic, tremendously abstract. I can zip off at the art of non-contradictory identification and say that in my sleep, and I'm sure you can too. That is no use by itself. That distinguishes logic from various other concepts. But it's entirely floating so far. What would the concretes be? And where would emotions come in here? I mean, I'm giving you a deliberately very abstract one. Well, I'll tell you what my mind would do right away with something like logic. It goes right away to an example of logical thinking that I like. A concrete example to which I have an emotional attachment. And there are a number of different possibilities that are automatized because I like logic, but liking it means you like something in actual reality, which is an instance of logic. So, for instance, I might think of the noblest act you have ever committed is the act of your mind and coming and concluding that 2 plus 2 equals 4, which is the conclusion of from premises, an example of drawing, of reasoning, of being logical. Or, even faster, my mind would go to, what's the obvious example bequeathed to us by Aristotle that all logicians feel a certain affection for? You know, the Socrates syllogism. All men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. So that would right away be a paradigm in my mind as an example of a syllogism, an example of actual reasoning, of actually thinking non-contradictorily. That would be an example that my emotion would take me to positively. But now to get a whole range, let us say, I would want a negative instance. I want an example that I don't like, but that also is an example of reasoning, at least an attempt at logic. I might think of Leibniz there and think, you know, if there's compounds, then there must be simples, and if there's simples, then there must be monads, etc., and so on. There's an attempt at non-contradictory identification. I don't like it, but it comes under a certain process. Now, since I've, of course, done a lot of work and taught this, etc., I have definite a range of emotions for a whole bunch of concrete instances. Now, this doesn't mean I have an emotion, obviously, for every example of reasoning. That would be, I mean, I'd have to be insane for that. I don't know them all. Anyway, but you just need 3 or 4, and then in the act of saying art of non-contradictory identification, right away your mind is focused on certain concretes which are there implicitly because this means something to you, and therefore that's where your mind goes. Now you can do this, as I say, really with any concept. If you're ingenious enough, it's hard with some, obviously. Now let us, for instance, do it with welfare state. That was the homework. Now blurt out a definition. Now you have to make a certain decision here. What are you distinguishing welfare state from? Obviously, distinguishing it from capitalism, right? Are you equating it with any form of the mixed economy? Is any system which has an element of freedom and an element of control a welfare state? No. Why? What would be an example that would refute that? Well, I don't see any hands. I don't know if that's because you don't know or you think I'm just being rhetorical. Yes? Well, you're going to the other extreme. I want an example that's part free and part controlled, but that is not a welfare state. Yes? Britain. No, Britain is a welfare state. Yes?
Well, a military dictatorship where all political thought was banned, but the economy was somewhat free and there was no social program.
That would be a possibility. I had in mind a completely different situation, the United States in the 19th century, which was a mixed economy, but did not concern itself with welfare functions. Or, as an extreme other example, you could take communism or totalitarianism, which certainly includes welfare functions, and in that sense is, quote, a welfare state, but has absolute total control, which therefore supersedes the whole point of saying it undertakes welfare functions because it undertakes every function. So totalitarian is the better definition. So, if we want a definition of welfare state in a way that would distinguish it. Now, I don't have to distinguish it from everything in history. After all, I'm not writing an encyclopedia, so I don't have to worry how does it relate to absolute monarchy and theocracy and every weird theory you can dredge up, but just a few. You'd say basically, it's a form of mixed economy characterized by extensive government concern for welfare programs, as opposed to merely protection of citizens' rights or sporadic economic controls without a systematized, organized program of welfare intervention. That's too long, obviously, but to blurt it out, a welfare state is a kind of semi-dictatorship with the focus on government providing welfare to the citizens, providing welfare programs, as opposed to just protecting from killers or army invasions and so on. Now, that's a general definition. Let's condense it to the welfare state. Its purpose is welfare. That's a little circular, but as long as you know what we mean by welfare, that's okay. I mean, specific welfare programs, not just the good of the citizens, because everybody's for the good of the citizens. The question is, what is that consistent? So we made a start here toward clarifying this concept. The definition was essential, otherwise it would just float forever. But we have not yet tied real. Now is where your concrete should come in. Your mind should arrange, and the thing that should make it easy is, do you have any, let's put it this way, pet peeves or any things you really like? Now, if you're left wing, your mind would go right away to what? Sweden. I mean, that would be your favorite, typically. You'd love that. That invokes an emotion in your mind, so at least to that extent, you know, it wouldn't be a floating abstraction. Your mind would go to Sweden. That's a concrete. That's one that I would go to right away, simply out of negative emotion. The same thing in reverse. I mean, I hate that idea, that particular concrete, because it's the, you know, the alleged candidate for the perfect welfare system where it all really works, etc. So my emotion would take me there right away. It would be impossible for me to talk about the welfare state without having Sweden as a foremost example, simply because the term welfare state would trigger antagonism, and antagonism would bring in Sweden. See what I mean? And that is the mechanism I'm trying to tell you to automatize the opposite of rationalism. If you let the emotions function, they will prevent you from being rationalist because they will flood you with the concretes that will make you focus on real. What else do you, are there? Now, in this particular category, you'd have much greater tendency to favorite negatives than favorite positives because of your political views. But that's okay, it could be any kind of emotion. What other concretes might come to mind as examples of welfare state as we are using? Yes?
I generally see the idea of paternalism as the essence of it.
That's an abstraction. I want a concrete. Paternalism is a characteristic, a statement of what the government does. I want, you know what we mean by a concrete? A concrete is where you could get a ticket on a plane and go there and land and say, here it is, this is Sweden, here's the borders. This is a specific country, an empiricist could find it. Now, when you concretize, this is a very important point, you must distinguish a concrete from an attribute. Paternalism is an attribute. It's a general characteristic of all welfare states that the government acts as your father, demands a certain authority. That is not a concrete. That is an aspect. A concrete means a particular, an instance, an example. You get what I mean? So what you're doing would not help you with rationalism at all. In fact, if you think that's a concrete, that'll positively harm you, because you'll say, I gave all the concretes, and your concrete will consist of four different abstractions, and the result will be that you will not know what you're doing. Is this clear what we mean by a concrete? All right, I want some concrete other than Sweden. I mean, the whole West is welfare states now, so it shouldn't be hard to find. Yes?
I particularly hate
social workers are not a concrete of the welfare state. They advocate the welfare state, but a welfare state has to be a state. It has to be a country. Social workers advocate, typically, programs that are essential to the welfare state, But that still doesn't give us an example of a welfare state. A welfare state has to be a state. Just as an example of logic has to be an example of thinking, of drawing conclusions from premises. In the back row. I can't hear you. No, sir. You're not listening to what I'm saying. Food stamps are not a country. Food stamps are a program. They are one concrete program under the welfare state in some countries. But they are not an example of the welfare state. They are an aspect of the welfare state in certain countries. A welfare state has to be a state. Food stamps are not a state. Is this a difficult point to grasp? It is difficult. Well, if I gave you the clue of Sweden, you could guess that the concrete would have to start with a capital letter. How's that? Yes. Great Britain. That is a concrete. Yes. Great Britain is definitely a welfare state. And it would be one, again, that you very probably have a special emotion for because it's been pushed as a tremendous symbol of a peaceful welfare state, the civilized welfare state, which all the leftists are in favor of. But there's another one even closer to home in Great Britain. Yes?
France.
Well, yes, France is a welfare state. It's not one that I have any special emotion for, but you might. That's okay. Yes? What else? Yes. What about the United States? Now, I mean, anybody that thinks about the welfare state who is an American and doesn't think of the United States is already in bad shape. Because the United States is an absolutely great example of the welfare state. And it has been since what year? Since 1933. Since the New Deal. Prior to that point, it was progressively mixed and controlled, but it was not a welfare state. That was the legacy of the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt. And that is therefore very instructive if you think of that concrete. Now, just to show you how your personal experience, your own emotions enter into this, I cannot think of the welfare state without thinking of another example that was never mentioned here because I spent 10 nightmare years studying this concrete. And that is, well, not just Weimar Germany, but Germany ever since Bismarck. Because Bismarck was the father of the welfare state. He originated it and it was then picked up by all these other countries. And the legislation that he passed in the 1880s became the model for all the rest of the world. He was like the new dealer of Germany. And from that point of view, to me, practically speaking, when I think about politics, as soon as I say welfare state, the four in my mind are Sweden, Great Britain, United States now, and since Roosevelt, and Germany since Bismarck. That comes automatically as my four pet negatives. I have no positive. But you see, you cannot be oblivious to these. If all you think is the welfare state as a general definition and then certain abstract characteristics, the whole thing is entirely floating. You won't actually recognize it when you see it. You won't connect your thinking to the actual reality. Now the last point. Name some attributes of welfare states that are not part of the definition. The definition states the idea of government welfare as the central purpose of the government. Name some attributes that are not definitional, but that nevertheless characterize welfare states. Now, there's no way to do this but to look at them. You can't do it by deduction from the definition because these are non-definitional. So you have to do it inductively. Now what I want you to see is if you have an array spread out before you, you should be able to just read off from that array a series of characteristics that are not the definition but are just as true, just as applicable, only they're not the ones that enable you to hold it in a way that distinguishes it from other concepts. Give me one such attribute. Now, this will be an abstraction, so you don't have to worry about that, but presumably concretized because you have actual examples before you. Is that you, Freddie? Yes. I think they all do offer unemployment insurance. There are certain core programs, I believe, which is universal, which are Bismarck's basic program. Unemployment. Although, you know, the Weimar Republic did not have unemployment insurance till 1926, I think. But nevertheless, it was a little slow on that one point. But typically, let's put it this way, there's a range of insurance programs, which is true of all of them. Unemployment, workman's compensation, old age, Medicare or Medicaid or outright socialized medicine. There's a whole constellation of those income supplement programs, etc., that vary within certain limits. Now, you wouldn't say a welfare state is one that and then list 25 programs because you couldn't hold it. And yet the presence of those programs is significant and is essential to grasping the whole phenomenon. All right, so that's one thing. The type of legislation. What else? A different thing now. Don't just give me another program. Yeah.
Proliferation of pressure groups, lobby groups.
Okay, good. Good. The proliferation of lobbying and pressure groups. That is true of all of them. And you can show that it comes from the nature of the system. People are free, so they have a chance to influence their future, and they're at the mercy of the government, so they have to influence the government, so they get together to do it. But you would never get that from just saying the government is going to provide for their welfare. How would you know? That's too abstract to take you anywhere. So you have to look around and say, yes, the proliferation of pressure groups. Now, that's a perfect example of a non-defining attribute. It's true of all. It's abstract. It's very instructive, but it's not part of the definition. And you cannot deduce it from the definition. Although, when you observe it, you can relate it to the definition. Yes? Can't hear you. Yeah, you could put that in. If you don't have that in with the welfare programs, how they're financed. They're financed generally by progressive taxation, or put it more broadly, by expropriation of the more productive citizens. That's how I would put it in unfriendly characterization. Now, that is not part of the definition, but you can see that, and you can see why it has to be, but not by deduction from the definition. What else? Yes.
Wage and profit control.
Can't hear you.
Wage and profit control.
Yeah, the tendency to economic controls over and above the welfare controls. And again, you could show that the welfare functions would be impossible except if the government controlled the economy and the consequences of all the various welfare functions. And that they needed a certain set of controls to get to the stage where they could have it. So that there's an inextricable tie-in between the welfare functions and the other control. And as soon as you saw that, you would then see that anybody who says we can have welfare and perfect freedom is ridiculous, you see. But again, you don't do it by definition, you do it by observation. Another characteristic. You see, you can go on, but you have to look at Sweden and Britain, etc., to do it. Yes, the yellow. Yes. Victimless crime laws is too far afield, I think, because in the long run, finally, everything is going to be a crime. But in the stage where it's still a welfare state, you have strong sets of opponents of victimless crimes on the liberal side who are still trying to preserve political freedom and welfare functions. And therefore, you could say simply a tendency to increase government controls would be a better way to put it, but not necessarily that specific one. And there, I would say, therefore, another very important, universal, but non-defining trait is what? They are all transitional, moving steadily in the direction of greater control. Now, this is a fact. It is not deducible from the definition. In fact, if you just looked at the definition, liberals will say, that's ridiculous. We only want welfare functions. We want freedom. The only way you're going to do this is what? Look at the countries and say, well, now look. Sweden did it, and this one did it, and look at the United States since Roosevelt, and look at Germany since Bismarck. And not just look and say, well, such is life, it's inexplicable. Well, why? What about the system? And then you can connect it to your essential statement to your definition, but only after you get it first by observation. Now, we don't have to do this forever and ever. There's more and more of them. But to understand welfare state, in other words, you have to have a definition which ties you to a whole set of concretes emotively automatized, which you then see a whole host of common denominators in. And then you realize that your definition simply is a condensation of all of those. And any time you're talking about the welfare state, therefore, on the one hand, you have in your mind this whole conceptual framework, everything you know, your definition, etc. On the other hand, all these examples. And if that is properly held in your mind, you can, you know what to do when you read something or talk to someone or think about it. You won't be either rationalist or empiricist. And you see, it's too much to do by painstaking step at a time. You have to automatize the concretes. And that was my point. See, this is not, this issue of emotion is not emotions as tools of cognition. Your emotions don't tell you anything. But what they do do is keep you in contact with reality. And that is the crucial thing. Now, ideally, you know, it would be good to do another dozen of these, but we can't. But I'm just a little bothered, let me say, about this issue of concretes, because I thought it would be obvious that the easiest thing would be to give concretes. Let me just take one more concept for the heck of it, only on that one point. Take the concept hero. H-E-R-O, not the sandwich. I want concretes only now. And we're not going to do the whole analysis. Now, here you should have an emotion. Your mind should go right away to certain instances. Now, and they should be a range, not just all one type. I have right away four that come like that. Positive and, well, I'll be quiet. Somebody. Now, I want only concretes here. Yes. Thank you. I appreciate that, but that is not exactly what I had in mind. Let's take another example. Thank you. Yes, at the back.
I think there was a gentleman out in Texas someplace. There was a book written about, and he was in the courts for a number of years over sending his children to public schools, which he did not want to do, and was murdered by the authorities, from what I understand.
Well, I'll let... All right. Let me abstract your concrete. You're trying to give an example of someone who did a heroic, courageous thing in the face of great odds. So, since I don't know that person, I don't want to get into those examples. I think we can find simpler examples. Now, from this audience, you should be able to think of some simple examples out of fiction, which qualify as an example of a hero. Howard Roark is a hero. John Galt is a hero. Now go away from objectivists, but still within the realm of fiction. Can you think of a hero out of romantic fiction, which is not the same as an objectivist hero, who does things that an objectivist hero would not, but is still a hero? A concrete with a long nose. Cyrano. Now go all the way out. Name somebody that the Nazis found heroic. I don't think even the Nazis thought Hitler was very heroic. But they did think Horst Wessel was a hero, in the sense of, and by completely opposite code of values, but in the sense of an extreme embodiment of physical strength and courage, etc. Or what would a Christian think of as a hero? Jesus would be the arch example. In other words, hero is simply like an extreme embodiment, a perfect idealized embodiment of a code of values with special emphasis on exceptional ability and courage. Now, to make that concrete, you have to be able to specify examples from different codes. And, of course, your emotions should flood you with those examples. And, of course, there are many non-defining attributes of heroes, but I don't want to take the whole class on that. Now, I hope that that gives you something to go on with regard to concretizing and the relationship, the role of definitions, why they're important, and yet on the other hand, why they are only one aspect. Yes, louder.
The process we just went through, an example of chewing.
Yes, this is an example of chewing. If you take chewing in the broadest sense as countering floating abstractions. But more specifically, this is what I think of as reduction of a concept, taking it back to reality. And you do that in three steps, in effect, by finding the definition, surrounding yourself with examples, and then inducing their non-defining characteristics, and then seeing those characteristics as being united back in the definition. That whole process brings the concept back to reality. That's what I call reduction. And you see, the whole point is that it is the opposite of the rationalist idea. And it's the opposite of the empiricist idea. You don't just sit and give examples either. The whole thing is the union of the two. That's going to be my theme next week. Harry, you had a question?
Would the collection of examples, at least some examples, precede the definition normally?
Well, you mean in learning the concept originally or in clarifying it once you have it?
Elaborate.
Well, to learn a concept originally, you have to know concretes. So until I grasp that there were certain countries like Sweden and Britain, etc., welfare state would be just meaningless to me. It's only when I would recognize there are such countries that I would try to grasp that concept as opposed to totalitarianism, etc. So certainly the concretes have to precede the abstraction in learning. But we're talking about now once you have a concept and you're trying to clarify it in your own mind. Now, I don't lay down as a law, first you must give a definition and then look for concretes at this stage. You might certainly do it in reverse, but the point is you need the guidance of a definition very badly, very soon, because otherwise you won't know what examples to give and you're going to confuse yourself thoroughly. You now have so many concepts that if you don't quickly demarcate it, you're going to give the example of Soviet Russia or United States in the 19th century or whatever, and then when you try to figure out the definition, you'll be lost. So there must be an interplay between the concretes and the definitions. And practically, I find that the best thing is to board out a definition as your basic anchor and differentiation, then a range of concretes, then the non-defining characteristics, and then tie those back to the definition. That's the procedure I recommend for systematic chewing of a concept. Yes?
Where, if anywhere, does the process of identifying different aspects or views or perspectives come in as contrasted with examples or instances or attributes when trying to understand?
Well, give me an example. I don't know what you mean.
Well, I...
The different views on the welfare state?
Well, an example that I gave, it was in fact an expansionist, but it was an example of paternalism. But you didn't treat that as a concrete, nor as an attribute. I don't believe you.
Well, paternalism is really, if you define it, inherent in the definition. Because the definition of a government which has the following functions, which is concerned to provide the welfare for its citizens, that is already, if not a restatement, simply an almost obvious implication that this is therefore going to be a paternalistic versus a government which leaves hands off. So that's simply an abstract characterization of what's true of a welfare state. Depending upon how you define it, it would either be part of the definition or one of the non-defining but intrinsic characteristics. See what I mean? But that is not a concrete. You see what I mean? Now, somebody mentioned food stamp laws. Those are a concrete law. That's a concrete under welfare legislation, but not under welfare state, you see. Yes.
The need
louder, please, stand up.
The need to have characteristics which are not expressed in the definition imply that the definition is not precise.
Wrong.
No, clarified.
Now, I happen to know that you don't know the objectivist theory of definition. This is the third way you've tried to get me to present it, which I cannot do. The objectivist theory of definition is very clearly stated in the Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. It is not the purpose of a definition to give an exhaustive statement of an entity's attributes, nor even a statement from which all of them can be deduced. If you want to know the objectivist view of definition, read the book I mentioned. But in a word, a definition condenses a concrete by taking one attribute which happens to subsume the greatest number of non-defining characteristics, but that leaves a tremendous number of other ones. But that's a whole subject in itself, which is a precondition of this course, as I think I told you the last two times you asked me that question. Now, I want to take a couple of questions just so I won't feel that we lost the whole question period, but this had to be done, so you'll have to forgive me if some of these questions get short shrift to the vanishing point. Isn't the empiricist concerned with reality usually from the outset a concern with emotions, so that it is subjectivist from the start? In some cases, but I would not say that. That depends. The attraction might be emotionless in various people, but philosophically speaking, it comes from a wrong view of concepts. That's the root. That's the way it is defended, by the detachment of concepts and from reality, and therefore the idea, if you want to be realistic, you have to be concrete bound. That's the root philosophically. And emotionalism is a consequence of that. So although it will attract emotionalists, that is not the philosophic primary, and I would not want to present it that way. That's too, in effect, psychological an interpretation, and I'm trying to cover these issues philosophically. Now here's a similar question that amounts to asking whether the guy, the professor that we quoted about shooting down the Soviet jet, was he really dishonest? Because, question, that isn't the wording, but this was the question. In addition to this professor's insistence on concretes, isn't his letter also an example of someone who is simply not wanting to accept the conclusion and, lacking good reputation, asks for examples to represent proof? Well, you're ascribing a motive, but you're saying, in effect, he really wants to get around it. And I'm sure this guy wants to get around it. There's no doubt in my mind of what his political views are. But the relevant point is, aside from what his motive is, what is his method? There are many different ways of breaking down the conclusion. One would be to construct a deductive argument to prove that Russia is paradise. That would be a rationalist polemics. Or to try to trap the argument in self-contradiction. But this guy wants concrete, so it is empiricist in its essential approach, regardless of its motive. Now, as to whether its motive is dishonest, I'd like to postpone that for Lecture 12, because our whole topic in Lecture 12 is what is honest and what is dishonest intellectually. So I'll leave you only with this thought. Empiricism, among its thorough practitioners, which I doubt that anyone in this room is that, I mean its philosophically committed practitioners, has a tremendous lobotomizing effect. It makes them actually incapable of grasping the most obvious points, because they have no conceptual apparatus at all. And therefore, I have heard empiricists advocate things which you would have to swear are dishonest because they're so stupid. And yet, after a long conversation, I've changed my mind and I've concluded that this person is literally not capable of grasping the point. His mind is so warped by his methodology. To me, it is conceivable that this professor was honest. For what that says of my, that is a grave indictment of empiricism. But it's conceivable. But we'll have to discuss that question in Lecture 12. Empiricists deal with each case or concrete separately. Therefore, it suggests that they do not believe in cause-effect relationships, which implies certain rules. That's generally true. They're not big on cause and effect. Hume rejected cause and effect outright. This is another way of saying they are indeterminists, as I defined that in the lecture. Then the questioner goes on, hence, why do they need to state a cause or causes for events, such as the American Civil War? Well, in other words, why are they pluralist, rather than simply saying there is no explanation of anything? Well, it depends the degree to which the syndrome has taken hold. Not all empiricists are as extreme as Hume. That type would simply say, what war? You know, let alone what the causes were. But a typical empiricist is partial. He partially conceptualizes, so he partially accepts cause and effect. And therefore, he will give some causes, but he won't conceptualize all the way or therefore unify them. These things exist on a continuum. They are not 100% or nothing. If they were 100%, either way, the person would be completely wiped out. He couldn't do anything because he would be completely cut off from reality. So some degree of proper functioning is inherent in crossing the street. I'll take one last question tonight. In Ludwig von Mises' Human Action, a principle of polemics is enunciated. In essence, he states that one shouldn't argue with a person's premises or theory, just look at the results of his argument. If you can show the person that his theory leads to disaster in reality, or to the opposite of what he seeks, he is refuted. Von Mises then goes on to examine socialism and many variants of statism, rejecting them all as disastrous and concluding that a free market is the best system, the only one leading to desirable results. Does this approach smack of empiricism? Is it flawed? I have not read that much of Mises, although I've read some of his work. But confining myself, therefore, to the question as worded, without necessarily saying that this is all he had to say on the subject of polemic, I would think both of these formulations are false. That is, are flawed, are incorrect methods of polemics. The idea of showing that a political theory is the opposite of what you seek, that formulation is pure rationalism, not empiricism. Because that's the idea of trapping the person in internal inconsistencies. And this idea, a socialist really wants the long-range welfare of mankind. Therefore, if I show him that it's going to lead to disaster, he'll be trapped in a contradiction that is pure rationalism. And I would maintain, with all due respect to von Mises, that you cannot do it that way. And that by conceding that at the outset, you mortally affect your ability to argue. That I would reject. Now, the idea that your theory leads to disaster, that is debatable. The question is, the statement is, the theory leads to disaster in reality. Before I could analyze whether that's a proper method or not, the question will be, how do you show that it leads to disaster in reality? By what means? Now, if you do it by showing that in principle, it is incompatible with the requirements of human life and production, then that's perfectly valid refutation. If you do it, however, by saying, look at what these countries actually led to in practice. Look at the disasters of all these countries. Therefore, the theory is no good. That is empiricism. In other words, it depends. Are you explaining why it didn't work conceptually, or are you just brute confronting people with the data? Now, Mises, I do believe, is much more on the proper method on this point. That is, he doesn't just say, look at the socialist countries. He shows what in the nature of socialism would lead to this. And to that extent, it is a proper principled attack, not simply rationalist or empiricist polemics. If I were to criticize him at all, I would say he has a tendency to rationalism, not to empiricism. But I do not know him well enough, really, to go into that. Well, we have to take a pause here, and next week we will continue. Thank you.